Today at Radio Verulam, we're once again speaking to local MP Bim Afolami to get the answers to your questions. And remember, if you've not been lucky enough to get an answer from Bim this time, he will be back again, not next month because we'll be in Purda, but the month after that. We are continuing these regularly, so don't worry if it's not in your news feed or on the radio for next month. But let's move it into the discussions here. And one of the positives since we had our last discussion, Bim, was it was Mother's Day. So were you able to celebrate Mother's Day with your own mum at all in a certain COVID-friendly fashion?
No. So what we did was I'm lucky that I have a very conscientious younger sister and younger brother who always stop me from doing terrible things like not get presents for Mother's Day. So they, and obviously, as you can tell, I obviously thought about this weeks in advance, which was very bad of me. So what they did was they sorted out presents and flowers and a video that my sister edited where I said what I loved most about my mother, which was a particular Nigerian dish that she does. She's half Nigerian, half English. And a particular Nigerian dish she does, which is not possible to get anywhere because she basically made it up herself. So that is what was in my little snippet for the video.
Oh, that sounds delicious. And a nice little insight as well, because last time we talked, you were a teacher. Now you're a movie star starring in your own film, just for your mum though. But that is quite interesting to learn about. Now, also this month, we had International Women's Day, obviously a celebration of all the accomplishments of females around the world, but also a time to highlight some of the injustices and the construction that works against women in society. So what did you do for International Women's Day, Bim?
In short, I was in Parliament, so I was, on some level, it was just like another, I think I was doing some work in Parliament. However, what I definitely did, and I was very careful to do, was light a candle for Sarah Everard. That was very important. I won't pretend to have any particular magic bullet as to what we do to stop that sort of thing happening. I won't pretend to know that. And to be honest, politicians always like talking about policy because it's things that they can do and laws you can pass. I think a lot of change comes through cultural change and what people regard as acceptable. 30, 40 years ago, it was acceptable to use certain sorts of words about certain sorts of people for sexual orientation or race, and it's no longer acceptable. That wasn't because a law was passed. It was because it became just not acceptable to do so. In this context, I just think that the way how, after hours, women going home, there are intimidating behaviors that I think every man knows they've seen or heard. And I think it's the duty of everybody to call these things out when they're not acceptable because it's intimidating and unnecessary. And of course, we all condemn, the violent attacks that happened or anything as awful as that. But it's often the lower level stuff that is just as intimidating for people because you don't feel you can walk home safely. So I think that it was very important as a cultural moment, I think, apart from anything else.
We will talk about Sarah Everard in just a second, but just on International Women's Day and what you're describing there as a change in ideas, a progress, if you will, a lot of that comes from learning, from reading, from kind of talking to individuals. Is there anything that you can recommend that maybe changed your mind or that you feel would change other people's minds?
I don't think it's a case that there are all these people who didn't think this mattered and now do, right? I think it's a question of how much as a priority is it for you. Most human beings are fair-minded and normal, and they don't frankly think about that much outside their own lives most of the time. And there's nothing wrong with that at all, but it's about making something a priority. And I think that that's what the difference is, and that's what we need to do. At the same time, I think that what we also need to do is bear in mind that having inclusive language more broadly about these things is very important. We shouldn't be trying to pit one group against another. But I don't think that's happened. I mean, there was some silly stuff around demonstrations and police, and look, I think 99.9% of people condemn all that. So I think it's important not to tar the movement with that brush. But I do think we need to make sure we have as broad a base support as possible. And then going right down to practical things, everything from street lighting to more police on the street to calling someone out when they, you know, chase up to a woman late at night and try and scare them just for the hell of it. You know, that sort of thing. All of those things need to be stamped out. And I think as a society, we can do that. And by the way, that includes women, men, you know, young men, younger women, older women. You know, it's actually collective.
And just continuing this Sarah Everard discussion here, obviously you're correct to kind of point it out, and we at Radio Verulam, and I'm sure you expressed this as well, Bim, our heart goes out to the family that has been affected, and many women as well across the capital, across the country, who are affected by these inequalities every day. But the discussion is now, what is the government going to do about this? You said that it's very hard to kind of pinpoint what is going to be done, but are there discussions? Can you illuminate what is being discussed in Parliament?
What I know is there are, frankly, a lot of discussions that you would expect. So you have people talking about police, you have people talking about street lighting, you have people talking about, you know, how we, you know, there's some proposals, I don't know, to put more plainclothes police officers in bars, and, you know, there's a whole bunch of stuff. But my fundamental view is this, is what I said before. I think that the big change, to be very, very blunt, you cannot stop all bad things happening. But what you can do is you can create a cultural atmosphere supported by good laws and well-enforced laws that make it much less likely certain things happen. And that is what we need to be working towards and building.
So for women who might be in danger in Harpenden and Hitchin area, you know, we can bring the discussion on a local level as well to try and help people. What advice can you give, or which services do you think that they can go to receive the help that they need when they are in danger?
Well, the first port of call is the police. The one thing I've heard, I was actually talking to one of my female colleagues last night about this, and they were saying that often women don't report things, so they don't think something will be done about it. And I do think that, I completely understand that, by the way, but at the same time, I do think reporting things is really important because the data and the figures will matter when people take decisions about what's to be done. And it's just so important we get those reports in. So the first one, of course, I'd say police, and also the local councillors. You know, the local councillors in Harpenden, I know they're very, very out and about. They are very present around the town. Everybody in Harpenden will live within 5 minutes walk of one of their local councillors, and making sure that they understand, because actually the local councillors have a very good relationship with the local police as well. And there are little things like, you know, have you heard a couple of people have been scared on that road because the street lights are out? Okay, we're going to get that fixed. Small thing, but can have a big impact. So that's what I'd urge people to do.
We are talking about security here, and we're going to move on to a national level, because a lot of eyebrows were raised this week as there were discussions of cuts to the armed forces, which was one of the Conservative campaign pledges, but then there was money found for adding more nuclear weapons. Bim, why are nuclear weapons being focused on in the 21st century?
So this is a really important point because it's a bit misleading, some of the news on this. Let me explain what this is. So in effect, we have a nuclear missile fleet. The issue with the integrated review was how much of our potential fleet do we arm at any given time? And what we are doing is arming more of our fleet when it is out patrolling. The point therefore being that they are an actual deterrent because they actually have the weapons on them. It is not that we are somehow like stockpiling nuclear weapons in the back. That is not what this is. It is really about using the capability we already have in a more effective way in order so that it can be a deterrent. The broader point about the armed forces is a very important one. And the truth is that, you know, the Treasury's put in, I think it's about £16 billion into the armed forces, an extra £16 billion. A lot of that money has come, therefore, effectively is replacing a black hole in the armed forces budget. but there is a lot of extra money in that, and it's going on much better kit with new technology so that we can fight the wars of the 21st century. There will be a small reduction in troop numbers of, I think, 3,000 or 4,000 in the army. I don't want to see that, but at the same time, put against the improved capabilities we have, that's a trade-off that the Chief of Defence Staff and others were willing to make. And it's important to make the point that when people are at the level of Chief of Defence Staff, head of the army, head of the navy, etc., these guys, their career is done, right? Like, there'll always be somebody who's, they're always going to be, I am Sir so-and-so who was head of the army. They're, in terms of status, they're already there. So they, to get them to agree to stuff, they really have to be pretty sure that they're getting value for what's going on, right? Because they can resign tomorrow and they could cause a huge amount of trouble for the government and if they didn't like what was going on. So they have been very much part of this. And so if they felt from a military capability point of view, and it's, look, it's not my specialty, but if they felt that this was a trade-off worth losing 3,000 or 4,000 troops, then, you know, I think that makes sense.
Okay, so we've talked about the troops there, but with the issue of nuclear weapons, you've explained that it would make the stockpile more efficient. But my question to you is, do we need to invest further in enlarging or making it more efficient? Because MI5 itself says that terrorism is the biggest national security threat that the UK currently faces. They also state that state espionage from foreign states, but also from individuals. How would nuclear weapons affect this, the greatest threat, as MI5 says itself, to the country?
Well, nuclear weapons is not particularly designed to face off against terrorists from wherever they appear. They are a deterrent for a lot of countries in the world that want to do very bad things to us and our allies. That's why we have them. That's why a few other of the major countries in the world have them, the French, the United States, and others, the Russians, various others. So the core question, though, are nuclear weapons required in the 21st century? Well, I'm afraid they are, as a deterrent. Nobody wants to use them, but that's the whole point. You've got to be ready to use them. And people have got to know that they're effective so that you don't have to use them. And I do strongly support that. I think that people who say, oh, we just need to unilaterally give up nuclear weapons, well, you are making the country less safe. That's the truth. Now, if you're a pacifist, and that's an honorable tradition, you know, if somebody says, I just do not believe in using armed forces in any circumstance, then that's a legitimate position. I don't, you know, frankly, I think this is a position Jeremy Corbyn was pretty much in, you know, he basically didn't support using force at any time. Well, fine, but I don't think it's not my position, definitely not. And it's not one that any responsible government in Britain over the last, 70 years has taken. So, yeah, that's my view.
One of the questions put to Mr. Corbyn was, would he press the nuclear red button? I throw it to you, Bim. Would you be comfortable with having that decision or at least backing up your government in making that decision?
Well, if I were in that position, well, of course you've got to. And if you weren't, and if you didn't think you could take that sort of decision, then you shouldn't be in the position of prime minister. Because, and to be fair to Keir Starmer, he said he would, if necessary. You know, so I think Keir Starmer has already made that judgment when he wanted to become leader of the Labour Party. It's the same one that our Prime Minister did as well. Because the hilarity of saying you are in charge of the nation's armed forces, but yet you're not willing to defend the country if faced with an absolutely cataclysmic threat, which is the reason why you would ever have to push the nuclear button, I think doesn't really make any sense for a country like ours.
So let's move it on. We're talking there about potential situations, you being at the nuclear red button or being prime minister. But this month you have had an impact in the House of Commons. In fact, you've had two impacts. The first of which is your private member's bill, the British Library Board power to borrow. Could you tell us about, first of all, the difficult process and then also the positive impact this is going to have for the British Library, but for the British population as a whole as well?
Yeah, so I'll talk about the impact first because the process is more boring. So basically, the British Library is not just that big building in St. Pancras. It has buildings all over the country. Libraries all over the country. It has one very big one in Yorkshire, and it has a couple of others. But that isn't even its most exciting function. Its most exciting function are what are known as its business and intellectual property centers, business and IP centers, all over the country that they're trying to expand. These centers provide advice, guidance, and help for people starting up and running businesses. Because anybody who started a business will know it's a very lonely thing to do. And people can make a lot of mistakes, and there's money at stake, and there's pride at stake, and there's a vision at stake. So if you can get the right advice at the early stage, it's really important. And the track record of these business and IP centers is fantastic. Businesses that have been advised by these centers are half as likely to go bust within the first 3 years compared to national average. So it really makes a difference. The reason why this bill matters is because it gives them the ability to borrow. Up until now, they've been prohibited by statute from borrowing any money. And that means including, by the way, borrowing money from the government, which is usually how the British Library would borrow money. That meant that they could not expand these business and IP centers nearly as much as they wanted to. And therefore, we are not bringing the great value of the British Library to as many people as possible. So this very simple bill, means that not only will there be more books lent and provided all over the country, but more guidance and assistance and help given to many more thousands of people who will be able to set up and run more successful businesses. So for me, it's really important. And as for the process, it's an individual piece of legislation that an individual member takes through. I've got a friend of mine, Ed Vasey, Lord Vasey, taking it through the Lords. And it means that effectively, you spend a lot of time negotiating with government about whether the government will whip to support it, or rather, in my case, effectively, it's whipped to not go against it, therefore letting it through. And it means that when it's all said and done, and we've got a good chance now of this all being said and done, when it's all said and done, it gets on the statute, which is an exciting thing, with your name on.
And this is your first private member's bill, isn't it, Bim?
It is. I mean, there are very, very, very few of them become law. I mean, historically, I think in the last, since post-war period, it's probably fewer than 100. In the context of, I don't know how many thousands of laws have been passed in that time. So it's a big deal. It really doesn't happen very often.
This is why I asked you about the process. I mean, personally, I'm interested in the process. I find the process of Parliament...
Well, someone has to be.
I'm one of those weird people that actually finds the process of Parliament fascinating. But this is the point, is that it is very rare to kind of see this go through. So this is a huge moment, not just in, you know, your history, but in the history of the country. One of those very few private members' bills coming through. Now, yeah. As I mentioned there is a second kind of impact that you are having in the House of Commons, and you're representing some of your constituents' views over the Luton Airport expansion. Can you explain your involvement on this one as well, Bim?
Yeah, I mean, I've been, and anybody from Harpenden will know, if they take an interest in this sort of thing, that I've been banging on about Luton Airport expansion ever since I was elected 3.5 years ago. There was a debate this week, a Westminster Hall debate, where Daisy Cooper, the St Albans MP, got a debate on this subject. And I made a very short contribution. It was Daisy's debate, so she did the lion's share of the contribution. But I made a short contribution to make points against the expansion. I won't list them all now, but I will say that I was amazed when I was listening to Daisy Cooper, and then I went back and read my own Westminster Hall debate 3 years ago, and it was just amazing when you look at sort of how similar the points were. Now, that matters because it shows there's such a consensus about the reasons why the airport expansion shouldn't happen. In fact, one should be worried if Daisy was coming up with completely different points, because you'd think, well, maybe this is all a bit scattergun and there isn't a settled view. You know, there is a very, very clear consensus in this area that airport expansion would be a bad idea for noise, for local, for the local environment. And you know, I am just very hopeful that the government at some point will not allow it to go ahead. But, you know, I don't want to, there's a lot of process. Talk about process. There's a huge amount of process around this. It's also a tricky time for the airports more generally because of COVID. And so I fully understand why the government doesn't necessarily want to sort of put the foot on the airport's throat right now. But, you know, in time to come, when things come back, this is something we're going to have to come back to again and again and again.
With these airport expansions, though, with any kind of expansions to the transport system, there is the playoff between the economic argument and the kind of local infrastructure, the effects that it will have. So, Bim, were you pro Heathrow expansion, and are you, as you've explained there, against Luton? I mean, if it is that playoff, because I think the government has been pro Heathrow, why is one kind of acceptable and the other is not?
Two reasons. One, nobody thinks, or rather not many people think, that you shouldn't have any airports, right? So you're going to have airports. My view is you should concentrate things like airports in where you have the biggest scale, in the same place, where you've got the best transport, where it's been, frankly, topographically the best place for the airport, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's where you should really try and find the, that's really where you should put the airport. And that's where, that's Heathrow in this country. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, there is a bit of a trade-off around flights. If you're going to expand anywhere, Heathrow's where you expand, because I don't think the public's appetite for the next 10, 20 years is going to be continuous expansion of airports. So if you do it Heathrow, then you take away the excuse of Luton Airport, which says, oh, well, you know, we need to expand because we need to improve airport capacity in the country. But if you just expanded the biggest airport in the country, how much more capacity do you need, right? So that's why I supported Heathrow. I think it should be concentrated in your biggest, most international airport, point one. And point two, if you're going to create any capacity, this is when you do it. You do it once and you do it in that same place.
The new police and crimes bill has caused a lot of discussion. One sticking point is that one of the new parts of the act curtails the ability to protest in the UK, citing that police can stop them if they cause noise and disruption to the public, which a lot of people point out are the basic principles of a protest, to cause noise and disruption. So the talk is now, though, that this may be removed from the final bill. Can you update us on this, Bim?
The bill passed with no amendments. So in the Commons, we'll see what the Lords do to it. This, I'm afraid, is misleading. The basic point of this is to try and make sure that when people demonstrate, which they have a perfectly legal right to do, and that they will be able to do, and will continue to be able to do, they do so considering the impact on other people, whether they be ambulances that can't go through a key road because people have decided to block it up, whether it be someone trying to run a business where you've got a bunch of people demonstrating and damaging property, for example. And I do not think it is, you know, unreasonable to say that when you protest, there has to be a judgment made and therefore consideration made around the impact on other people. Yes, you have a right to protest, but you don't have a right to just disrupt other people's businesses, livelihoods, lives, just for the hell of it. That needs to be worked out with the police so that, and I make this up as a small example, you go down X road rather than Y road because Y road's got a grocery business that needs lots of deliveries on every few hours, which means that you can't demonstrate in front because the lorries can go down. For example, I'm just making that up. So that is the issue. It does not stop people protesting. It's really about trying to make sure it's done in a safer way as possible, in consideration of as many people as possible.
On ITV, you talked about not taking the knee, and instead that individuals, if they want to bring about societal change, they have to do actions. So I'm giving you an example, maybe the Martin Luther King protests that you cited yourself. Would that be allowed? Would that be banned? Because that was obviously highly disruptive to Washington in the 1960s.
It was highly disruptive, but you know what? You're talking about the March on Washington 1963. That march was done with the full cooperation of the National Guard, right? And it was done with full cooperation of the National Guard. You have several members of Congress on that march. You have, I mean, it was a huge, huge march, and was done with full cooperation and understanding with the National Guard in the US Capitol, right? That, of course, would be allowed. A bit like we have, you know, we have demonstrations all the time, and that will continue to happen. In fact, the civil rights movement and Gandhi, for what it's worth, in India, not that, by the way, I think our current situation is analogous to either of those things, but they were always very careful about the impacts of their protests on other people, because frankly, they were protesting in order to garner support for their cause. And they were very, very careful politically about who they affected.
So let's move it to the final question before we get into the community discussions. And a sobering thought, we've had quite a few so far in this discussion, but it is in fact a year since the country went into lockdown.
Gosh, and is it that long? Yeah, it is.
It does feel a long old time, doesn't it? And COVID-19's impact is still being fully realised. We don't know the long-term ramifications, but what are your reflections of a year dealing with COVID in Harpenden and Hitchin, but on a governmental level as well?
Really, I mean, look, it's been very, very difficult for everybody. I think there are two main things. The first is obviously the health impact. And I can say that, and I'm not trying to claim this is down to me at all, but in this area, we've had some of the lowest rates of COVID deaths in the country. But there's still been quite a significant number. But at the same time, the vaccination rollout, and I've seen firsthand volunteering in Harpenden on Friday afternoons that I do, has been so fantastic, and seeing the community come together. Organizations like Harpenden Cares, working with local people, with the community, again, coming together, the Harpenden Trust. I know there'll be others in St. Albans. I don't know them all, but I know that, you know, there are many organizations that exist as well, and you see it all over the country. But at the same time, we've seen the unprecedented economic support given to businesses. I was speaking to a businessman in Harpenden earlier on the phone, and he was talking about, you know, gosh, you know, if it hadn't been for the bounce back loans, which are interest-free, well, not interest-free, but, you know, very low interest loans given to businesses. He said, look, we wouldn't have been able to stay afloat. You know, the various other, the furlough scheme obviously being another huge one, and seeing the impacts of that. So actually, I think as a country, we've responded overall quite well. Now with the government roadmap, we are now pretty confident getting all out of this as quickly as possible. And once we can, then I think obviously we'll have to unwind some of that support. But I think that people appreciate and know and understand that we have kept things, you know, for the vast majority of people, we've kept things going so that they can survive. Of course, you know, there are a lot of businesses. I know a lot of people running businesses who, you know, have had a really tough time, but they still have their businesses. Their businesses didn't go bust. By contrast, in lots of other countries, they chose not to necessarily help businesses nearly the way that we did. They chose to focus their support on individuals. And that's fine. It's a different way of doing it. But what it meant was a huge number of businesses went bust. The hope in those countries is that people will start new businesses. And again, a lot of them will. But personally, I think the way we've done it is better, though it comes with its own challenges. And obviously, we'll have to unwind everything, you know, in a way that doesn't create too many difficult cliff edges.
You personally have worked very hard during this period, you and your backroom staff as well, to kind of see these through. You've talked about previously, like you have there, of the loan kind of schemes, but week in, week out, month in, month out, you've been helping individuals with all kinds of problems. And I think that is testament to a lot of MPs' work. I mean, this is one of the things that people don't realise about members of parliament, that yes, you're in the House of Commons, but also week in, week out, Bim, you're there on the front line for your people in Harpenden and Hitchin, aren't you?
Yeah, it's fair. I mean, really, my team deserves so much praise, because I spend so much time often doing, you know, making speeches or dealing with things in government or that sort of thing, which can be tight time consuming, but all the time. I mean, we get probably 250, 300 emails a day, of which half are, you know, relevant constituency complaints, concerns, thoughts about votes, thoughts about what the government should be doing, you know, a mix of stuff. But we get a lot of stuff through, and they are the people who pick up the lion's share of it. So really, the praise should really be for them. And it's, I get the easy bit because they, you know, they do all the triaging, they do all the tough work, and say, right, Bim, we need you to speak to these five people. We need you to make these phone calls to the right councillors, these letters we need to get written to the right government departments, etc. But before it gets to me, there have been so many other things they've already dealt with. So, so you know, they deserve, you know, the praise for that.
And just on this final discussion point here on COVID-19 and things like that, I actually want to bring in Albert Camus. Now, I'm not sure if you like his work. I'm not sure if the Conservative Party are a big fan of his, but I think...
Well, The Outsider, A l'étranger, was a very good book.
There are two other books, though. Well, two of his works that I want to highlight, though, The Myth of Sisyphus and The Plague. And I think they both bring in different kind of discussion points about how to deal with the plague that is our COVID-19. The first of all, The Myth of Sisyphus, I think one line that is very important is he explains that at times of crisis, it is lucid reason knowing its limits. And I think sometimes people are very critical of the government, and maybe it's knowing the limits of, at a time of crisis, of the individual. And the second thing is with the plague, the allegory is about the importance of decency. And so on those two issues there, do you think that people have been too critical at times, knowing how difficult it has been to handle COVID? And the second thing is do you believe that the Conservatives have acted, as in the plague, with decency at its heart?
Such a clever, interesting question. I think at times of crisis, it's important not to try and be the only sober person at a party when everyone's drunk, because you don't quite experience the party like everyone else. And what I mean by that is you do need to remain sober and clear-minded to some degree, but you also need to get a sense of what people are feeling. And that is the real difficulty in a crisis. Most of the time in politics, you know, you want to be the sanest person in a room full of mad people. That's what you want to be. But actually, in a crisis, on some level, you've got to understand and really feel some of the emotions yourself, or you won't get the right decision. You won't make the right decisions. And in terms of decency, it's my view that there is a difference between sort of criticism because you really believe things can be done better. Criticism because, though you can't think of anything to be done better, you just don't like what was done. And then criticism just for the hell of it because, you know, it's what you do. And I think there's been all three. I think more broadly, we have tried to do the right things. I think that the fundamental difficulty is that lockdown as a policy tool is something that you can easily do. You know how to do it. It requires you to pass laws. But the costs of it are hidden, but the benefits of it are quite, benefits isn't quite the right word, but you know, the things that you're trying to achieve are quite discernible. And if you give people a choice between simple, clear, effective, and the opposite of those things, people will go for simple, clear, and effective. The obvious problem is that the costs of lockdown are considerable. And I, every single time I've thought about this, spoken to colleagues, spoken to the Prime Minister, voted on any of these pieces of legislation or regulations, I've been fully cognizant of that fact. And really, over time, we'll see what people think is the best, sort of what people should have done. The one thing I would say is when people compare Britain to other countries or vice versa, I would just urge people to wait till the end, because I remember when everybody was saying, oh, Germany is the new Valhalla. It's all amazing and everything Germany does is amazing. And the way they've handled the vaccine rollout has been appallingly bad. Merkel wanted to propose a 5-day lockdown over Easter. 24 hours later, she just reversed it. Completely mad what's going on in Germany. I'm not, by the way, saying Germany's terrible. What I'm saying is, in the course of this pandemic, there have been all sorts of fits and starts. And when people talk about death numbers and maximum, I think that ultimately we just need to wait and see the whole thing play through. And only then will the judgments really be able to be told overall.
So we move into the discussions from the local community here, Bim. And as always, with these questions we always put out from Radio Verulam to the community, calling for questions that you can send to my email, jason.mckenna@radioverulam.com. And just to remind people, we will not be on next month. We will be returning in May to answer your questions. But Talia has sent in a message about the government's amendment to a bill that protects the employment rights for pregnant people. Her worry is about how that is going to affect transgender people, because previously this bill was gender neutral. But when it reached the House of Lords, the gender neutral nature of this was removed for only, it seems, pregnant cisgender women. Bim, will you step in and intervene on what seems to be a discriminatory act of legislation by...
It's not. I mean, I'm sorry. I'm afraid it isn't. I think everybody, you know, the vast 99.9% of people realise that when it comes to childbirth, there's a biological process that can only be done by people who are born women, right? That is a fact. This is not about people's right to live as who they want to be. This is not about even people who go as far as to have sex changes. This is about a biological process that you can only have a baby yourself if you are born a woman. And I think that that's just so blindingly, plainly obvious. I do think that we shouldn't always try and find ways to be offended in all these things. It is important that we recognise rights of people, as I say, who are transgender, or as I say, whether it be transgender transitioning or whether they fully go through all the difficult processes that people have to go through. But this is not something that people should really be arguing about. Everybody knows the facts when it comes to childbirth, right?
The discussion point, though, is that usually in terms of legislation, the gender neutral term of person is used, and specifically woman was put into this bit of legislation.
Yes, I happen to think that we should have put woman in at the first bit place. So, you know, but we've tied it this, but, you know, we fixed it.
Let's move it on to Andy's question. And he said, last month you talked about the success of vaccinations in the Harpenden area. Is it still going well? And also, when should someone like myself, who has just turned 40, there was a big emphasis on just, to expect getting the jab?
Well, he sounds like my friend Jesse, who's had his fourth 40th birthday party. He actually does that. He literally says it's my fourth 40th or my third 40th or my fourth 40th. And then he'll have a 50th after his whatever, ninth 40th. In terms of timing, we're now coming too late. We're in late March, almost certainly in April. But he should ask his Harpenden GP, if his GP's in Harpenden, which I hope it would be, as to that. It is still going well. The truth is that it's been going so well because it's become so efficient that it doesn't actually have to be in operation every day. And Dr. David Hempsey, who's the head of the primary care network in Harpenden, him and I had a call with Nadeem Zahawi, the vaccines minister, to talk about some supply issues. And David Hempsey was concerned that the government and NHS England didn't sort of want to prioritise smaller vaccination centres like Harpenden. I was also concerned, but we've been given very clear, very public assurances that we are, you know, valued. And as a heads up to people, I think that it's not unlikely that we are going to have autumn vaccinations of maybe a booster COVID jab for vulnerable groups. I don't think everybody, but maybe for people over 60 or over 70. And I fully expect Harpenden to be used then as well.
Steve has turned the topic onto something about policing in the area. He said he is a retired Hearts police officer and he is worried about policing in the area. He explained that BIM has said that currently he supports the PCC and is sure that he has policing numbers and confidence in him. This is despite Hearts Police having the badge of honour being the force with the lowest officer morale in the UK. He says the source is the Hearts Police Foundation. As our local MP, he asked, I expect you to know about security. Do you avoid these issues or are you refusing to engage with them? I'm seeing my former colleagues really struggling. What do you have to say about that one, Bim?
Very good question. I do engage with it. The honest truth is members of parliament, our ability to affect policy issues around policing is comparatively small, smaller than in other areas, but I know the local police officers, I deal with them, I see them. And when something happens, as happened with an illegal traveller encampment in Redbourne not so long ago, I rang up the local police and I said, you got to get down there when something was going on. And they did it. So, you know, they're very responsive. I didn't realise that they have the lowest morale. I really didn't realise that. And if the gentleman wants to get in touch with me, I'm very, very happy to talk to him about what he thinks needs to be done with his former colleagues. I'm happy to talk to him and maybe a group of his former colleagues who are friends or whatever, because I think that, you know, I didn't know that. And I'm keen to see what we can do to put it right.
These are moments that I like on Radio Verulam, politics in action, and hopefully we can help Steve out there and see a positive change. Cheryl has asked the question about who writes the answers to personal emails and letters sent from you, BIM. She feels that they are reproduced for the public and on Facebook, showing that despite all the questions being different, the same stock answer is given. BIM, can you tell us about this process?
It's very, very important that you give the same answer. Shall I tell you why? Because if somebody asks about, let's say, the policing bill, and yes, sometimes people have slightly different questions, but overall, people want to know what your view is on the bill. If I were to tell one person one thing and somebody else something else, then what does that say about me and the reasons why I'm doing something, right? So I think it's very important that we have an ordered process so that when there is an issue, I have a very clear view that I explain to everybody what my view on a subject is. Frankly, if people think that, you know, that is somehow wrong, I'd love to see how they would prefer to do it. If they want me to have a say one thing to them and one thing to somebody else, I can imagine the opposite criticism. Bim, my friend and I both wrote you emails on this bill and you told one friend X and you told another friend Y. I don't think that's better, frankly. In terms of the process, as I say, we get hundreds of emails a day. How it works is when there's an issue, I explain to my team my clear view of the issue, and my team, when it comes in on that particular issue, they respond. Sometimes, of course, it's something that isn't a common issue or it's a bit random or bespoke, we have to have a more, you know, we have to have a bespoke sort of response that's just a bit different. But generally speaking, when it's on an issue, you know, it's on, I don't know, police bill, abortion, transport policy, Luton Airport, what we're doing, various things that come up a lot, because 90% of what we see is things that come up frequently, as you'd expect, then it's very, very important that I'm fully appraised of the issues and that I communicate very clearly what I'm doing, what I haven't done, what I hope to do. And that's how it works.
Sebastian has written in and said, last show you talked about wanting to work on the economic side of the government. He said, can you not apply for that role? How do MPs get selected for certain areas? Surely it would be best for people who have an express interest in a certain area to work in those departments.
I'm afraid politics does not quite work like this. So, you know, you say you've got an interest in working in economic policy, but the economics of a government could be higher education. It could be local government. It could be obviously in the Treasury, but, you know, if you're working on, say, financial services in the Treasury, that's only one part of the economy. If you're working in skills policy, you probably affect more, right? So I think that when I say economic policy and economic policymaking, I make that point quite broadly. And in terms of applications, look, politics is a funny business. It's not a job, it's a vocation. You do a job in the government if the prime minister thinks that you have an ability there that he needs. And if he doesn't think you need it, you get fired or moved. And that's just how it works. It's because the skills you need to be a good minister are not just ones about a familiarity with the subject. They are broader ones about communication, your ability to deal with colleagues, your ability to deal with stakeholders outside. You know, the bunch of different stuff comes into it. And, you know, I don't think application process works in any political. I don't think I know one political system where that happens.
Final question here, Bim, and it's from Nicola, and hopefully it elicits a positive answer. But she said on the 26th of April, a lot of things are opening up again. Are you excited? And what will be one of the first things that you do?
I'm very excited. What am I going to do? I mean, the truth is that I'm going to spend a lot of time seeing friends, basically. That is what I'm going to focus the rest of my year on, is seeing friends, because I haven't had a chance to see them. I'm also very excited about the House of Commons getting back to normal in June. I think that'll really matter, the chamber being back to how it was, because we can't really function properly like this. But yeah, seeing friends. And my children being able to hang out with lots of other people, et cetera. I think that's very, very important for their development as well. So, yeah, so that's what I'm looking forward to.
And you talked about the British Library there. Will you be making a trip to it as well, maybe to get...
Oh, gosh, yeah. No, I'm a big fan of the British. In fact, the last time I was there was someone from Harpenden there who was setting up a business and they were getting advice. That was what was happening the last time I was there, because it's not very far from Harpenden at all. You just go on the Thames link. It's not far at all. So yeah, I will be going there, and I've got to go meet them anyway and talk to them about plans and various things. So yeah, very excited about that.
Well, as always, Bim, thank you for your time today.
Thank you. Thank you. Real pleasure.